Well, Samira, thanks so much for talking with us today. I'd like to start out by asking you about the report that you just released called Under the Radar, and it's a report that has some disturbing findings. In the report, you show how the government is targeting Muslims using immigration and other laws against them in ways that are pretty discriminatory and troubling. Could you explain the report's major findings to someone who just wouldn't be familiar with these issues? What would you say?
Sure. So basically, since 9/11, the federal government has relied heavily on immigration laws and policies to prosecute the so-called war on terror. And the reasons for doing so are pretty clear. You know, there are fewer checks and balances in the immigration system. It's a lot more easier to arrest, detain, and investigate someone under immigration law than it is under criminal law. Some people may not know, unlike the criminal legal system and immigration court, an individual is not guaranteed an attorney. There's no right to a speedy trial in front of a jury. And, you know, the government doesn't have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in front of an independent judiciary. So because, you know, there are these lesser protections, you know, and the lesser protections obviously across the country have affected people from all racial, ethnic, and religious backgrounds and led to increased detentions and deportations nationwide. But what our report demonstrates, they've also allowed federal officials to undertake several initiatives that have specifically targeted Muslim immigrants in the name of national security. And, you know, while in the past the government, under the previous administration, adopted nationwide discriminatory policies such as the NSEER special registration policy that targeted practically every immigrant from a Muslim-majority country, our report kind of updates that and demonstrates that while policies such as NSEERs may have ended, the government continues to use the immigration system in other ways to arrest, detain, deport, and deny immigration benefits to innocent Muslims, largely on false national security-related allegations, which our evidence and our report demonstrates are based largely on innuendo, religious and cultural affiliations, and even individuals' political beliefs.
In the report, you cite the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report, and you also talk about George Orwell's novel 1984. And in both of these things, there are special government forces that arrest someone even before a crime has been committed, and even if there's no substantive evidence against a person. So is that legal? Can you, in the real world, can you target someone and arrest someone just for predicting what they might do?
Unfortunately, under the Immigration Nationality Act, the government can arrest, detain, and deport an individual if they believe the individual is, quote, likely to engage in terrorist activity at some point in the future. And this, you know, unfortunately, is a very broad standard. One case that was recently applied to that we mentioned in the report is a Palestinian man in California. And in that case in particular, you know, the government admitted that he had not taken any action towards any terrorist or criminal activity, but, you know, said he was, quote, likely to engage in terrorist activity based on a variety of tenuous factors, which included his university education in computer science, his clean criminal record, the fact that he had an American immigrant visa, which, you know, they all claim that that evidence would make him an attractive recruit for Hamas, you know, which is the militant group and political party that currently governs the Gaza Strip where this individual grew up. You know, unfortunately, the standard's so broad that these sort of factors would likely subject any young Palestinian professional from Gaza to, you know, arrest, detention, and deportation here in the U.S.
And what you're saying is it's almost a catch-22 because the more innocent you appear, the more guilty you are. So the fact that you don't have a criminal record, the fact that you're here legally means that you could move around easily and you could be – is that what they're saying?
Yeah, unfortunately, that was – you know, they had an expert witness in this case who said because that guy appears to be so innocent, he would be a good recruit from Hamas, even though they didn't have any evidence that he himself was a member of that organization, had any interest in becoming a member of the organization. You know, he repeatedly at his immigration hearing denied, you know, any support for terrorism, denied that he was a member of Hamas or even, you know, supported any of their views. But that was evidence, unfortunately, that the government used, and in this case, you know, the court believed what was valid to detain and deport this individual.
So the lack of the evidence was the lack of evidence. How did that story end? What happened?
So currently, unfortunately, you know, they appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit agreed with the government. And so I'm not sure whether the individual is currently in detention and his attorney is planning to try to appeal to the Supreme Court, or if the government has, you know, effectuated his removal and deported him back to Gaza.
Wow. For a minute, I just want to play devil's advocate with you and imagine an argument. It's not my argument, but an argument that would go like this. And it would say something like, you know, the most important thing is that we keep America safe. And so if in doing that, a few innocent people like the gentleman you just mentioned are wrongly accused, well, that's a small price to pay. And it's much better than letting a real terrorist slip through the cracks. So how would you respond to that argument?
You know, I think I'd respond in another ways. You know, I'd first challenge the assumption that you make that only a few innocent people have been harmed by these policies. Under NSEERS, the special registration policy, for example, approximately 80,000 people, all from Muslim-majority countries, registered with the government. And, you know, these are 80,000 people, individuals who came forward to try to help the government in the war on terror. And, in fact, 14,000 were placed in deportation proceedings, which, you know, devastated their families and friends here in the U.S. And even today, our report shows that there are an untold number of individuals who are harmed by discriminatory policies on a daily basis. You know, almost every American Muslim can probably tell you a story of a family member or friend who's been affected by these policies. Second, you know, I would also say that, you know, if we believe in the protections of due process and equal protection, which are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, we should believe that they apply to all U.S. residents, regardless of their religion or country of origin. You know, if America's only goal was to prevent terrorist attacks, we could shred the Constitution and live in a police state. But, you know, I don't think that's what this country is all about. And, you know, the final point I would argue is that by abiding to the Constitution and protecting the rights of all its residents, I believe that that would actually make America even safer. I mean, there's evidence that discriminatory policies alienate groups and individuals that are needed most to help law enforcement. A lot of law enforcement and police officers argue that, you know, effective law enforcement strategies work with communities in fair and honest ways to identify real threats. In this particular case with the war on terror, you know, the policies can also have a negative effect on American foreign policy. And, you know, in the global fight against terrorism, it all obviously has to be an international effort. And these discriminatory policies undermine our credibility overseas with other countries and also raise doubts regarding our commitment to our own values as well as international human rights norms.
So the way you just described it, the stakes are pretty high in terms of the Constitution being at stake. So in a way, how would you explain to everyday Americans who probably might not know a Muslim, who are worried about jobs and keeping their homes and raising their kids and health care and all of that, and they might say, well, you know, what does that have to do with me? So is there a connection, and why should people who aren't directly affected care about the findings of your report?
You know, I think there's a lot at stake here. You know, as you mentioned, Americans today probably first and foremost care about the state of the economy, and a big thing we see in the headlines a lot is government spending. And it's clear that discriminatory policies and practices outlined in our report are a huge waste of taxpayer resources and don't make America safer. Take that NSEERS policy that I'll bring up again. That, you know, it's clear that the government wasted millions of dollars to create this database that targets tens and thousands of Muslim immigrants. And in the end, not a single person of those tens and thousands was ever convicted of a terrorism-related crime. Again, if people want to be safer, these policies arguably make America less safe, because instead of going after individuals who face a credible and specific threat to American security, law enforcement has to waste their time going after innocent people. Another point I'd make is, you know, we really need to remember the history of the United States. And at various times, different groups of people have been subjected to widespread discrimination. Native Americans, African Americans, women, the Irish, Jews, Catholic, Chinese, Japanese, Latinos, homosexuals, and I think the list goes on. And, you know, while Muslims and immigrants today may face the brunt of discrimination in a lot of ways, you know, it may be a different group tomorrow. And I think that reminds all Americans that we are really in this all together.
So you released the report Under the Radar a few weeks ago. Can you tell us what the response has been? And then also maybe talk a bit about what your recommendations are, what you say needs to happen, and how do we get there?
Sure. You know, the response has been overwhelmingly positive, especially from, you know, the immigrants' rights, civil rights, and Muslim American communities. I think most people recognize that this report represents a missing piece in both the immigration debate in this country, as well as advocacy regarding Muslim civil rights issues generally. We've also received some positive response from the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. As for next steps, we believe there needs to be both large-scale and small-scale changes in current American immigration law and policy to ensure individuals' due process and equal protection rights are protected in the immigration process. We support proposed legislative changes, some that, you know, have been already introduced in Congress, such as the End Racial Profiling Act, as well as the Justice Act, which is another, both acts kind of reach the goals that we think would help alleviate some of the problems we address. And we also support changes within the executive branch, Department of Homeland Security itself, to, you know, alter their own regulations and their own memoranda and use their prosecutorial discretion to make sure individual civil rights are upheld, and, you know, that they're really using their limited resources not to discriminate on a large scale, but to target real and serious threats to American national security. I think one overall goal of the report is really to broaden the immigration reform debate in this country, which, you know, today it seems to be in the media largely focused on issues of Latino undocumented immigration, and to have people understand that more in a more broader sense why, you know, the current immigration system is broken and continues to devastate families from a broad spectrum of races and religious backgrounds. In that way, we hope that this report will help broaden the coalition fighting for more humane and just immigration laws.
One of the policies that's used in immigration enforcement is called secure communities, and I'd like to ask you about that for a minute. It's a controversial program, and it's just been changed or tweaked a little bit by the White House. What's your view and your assessment of secure communities?
You know, secure communities and I think other initiatives that empower local law enforcement to help enforce federal immigration law are a bad idea, I think, for a number of reasons. First, I think these programs make, you know, America less safe. Many police chiefs actually from around the country are opposed to these programs because they divert their limited law enforcement resources from serving and protecting communities to enforcing federal immigration law. You know, they also decrease trust between law enforcement and local immigrant communities. Individuals with vulnerable immigration statuses are less likely to report crimes and cooperate with law enforcement officials if they know it is likely they may be placed in deportation proceedings for doing so. Additionally, these policies almost always lead to racial profiling, as local law enforcement generally target people of color when enforcing immigration law, you know, especially Latino and Asian communities are particularly affected, I think. Finally, you know, although the government has repeatedly stated that secure communities and programs like it, that they only want to go after the most dangerous criminals, all of the data that's just been released about these type of policies suggest otherwise. And the vast majority of individuals who are deported under these programs have been either convicted of minor offenses or many times nothing at all.
Thanks. I want to just widen the lens a little bit and go back to your report and some of the findings in a larger way, which shows a number of very serious and troubling abuses against Muslim American communities that are real and that are happening. And as you said, if you speak with a Muslim American, probably everybody has a story of something that's happened to them or someone they know. So that's the reality on the ground. But then the public perception is really quite different of Muslim Americans being other or being seen as suspicious. And there's very little public awareness of these injustices and this basic unfairness. Why is there such a gap, do you think, between the reality on the ground and the perception and the rhetoric, and how can we make that gap smaller?
You know, I think there are a variety of reasons for that gap. You know, unfortunately, one reason is that the threat of terrorism, you know, still exists today, and the United States is currently engaged in three wars with Muslim-majority countries in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. I think another part to blame is the media, as, you know, it tends to focus on and sensationalize negative depictions of Muslims across the world. You know, there's also an industry, unfortunately, of anti-Muslim bigots in this country who are making a lot of money to speak at events and to travel across the country and to sell their books that demonize Muslims and spread lies such as, you know, Islam and Muslims and the Sharia are all threat to America and the American way of life. You know, as most of what I've been talking about today, I believe discriminatory government policies also don't help. You know, when the government legitimizes discrimination against a group of people, it's only natural that the general public will also view that group with contempt. You know, finally, and I think to kind of conclude on a more positive way and, you know, what we can do to narrow it, I think that American Muslims ourselves need to do a better job of sharing our stories with our fellow Americans and showing them, you know, who we really are. We also need to strengthen our coalitions with our neighbors, our friends, and other communities that share similar concerns as we do, you know, as well as engage civically with our local, state, and national governments. And I think only as we continue to do these sorts of things will that gap between, you know, the reality and the perception narrow, and we will be able to move forward in a more constructive way.
Well, speaking of looking forward, let's look ahead about 3 months, and we will come upon September 11th and the 10th anniversary of the attacks in 2001. As you look at that 10-year period from 2001 to now, how do you assess those 10 years, mistakes that were made, opportunities, challenges? What lessons have we learned? And again, what do you think needs to happen going forward?
Sure. You know, in the days and weeks after 9/11, America was probably as united as it's ever been in its history. You know, like all Americans, you know, Muslims across the country did all we could do to support our country in those challenging times. Yet, however, even as, you know, President Obama acknowledged in his famous speech, you know, this past year in Cairo, Egypt, that government policies in the aftermath of 9/11, and this is to quote him, led us to act contrary to our traditions and our ideals. With the election of President Obama, I personally had hope, and I know a lot of other people did, that his administration would make a clear break from the previous administration's policies and usher in a greater era of civil liberties, for everyone. Unfortunately, with regards to national security policy and it relates to the Muslim American community, for the most part, a change in rhetoric hasn't really led to a change in policy. We all know that Guantanamo Bay is still open. The Department of Justice has not held anyone accountable for government abuses since 9/11. And instead, we've seen a continuation of many of the previous administrations, both immigration policies as well as national security policies. For example, with regards to immigration, the government, this past year deported more people than at any time in its history. What I see moving forward, at least particularly from the American Muslim community, as I mentioned, is that, we really need to continue to work together with other communities across America to continue pushing for, more humane and just policies for all of us, regardless of your ethnicity, your religious background, your sexual orientation, et cetera, as well as, strengthen our engagement with our political leaders. And I think not only, and until our voices, continue to grow and become stronger and unified, only then I think will we see the fruits of our labor. And let's hope, in another 10 years, we will see those changes.
Well, Samira, thanks so much for talking with us today. Thanks for doing your report Under the Radar, and thanks for the good work that you do.
Thanks so much, Sally.
Take care.
All right, take care. Bye.